Now we're going to have our full panel discussion, so I'm going to call up the previous speakers to join the four people on the stage. And also, I have some cards with written questions, but we're going to take questions by mic, and also we can do it electronically via the app, Dr. Kotenko told me. I think Dr. Tadani's point on changing this mindset and adopting more of the cultural mindset that the oncologists have, where they're, if you're not presenting a trial to a patient, it's the exception. We really have to encourage this and change this culture where we are looking very actively, partnering with patients and getting them enrolled in clinical trials. And I think the momentum has increased over the past few years with industry collaboration, and given all of this elegant work on deeper molecular phenotyping and the genomics that are being done, it's really bringing a really wonderful, fertile landscape to collaborate and innovate and find therapies for these patients. Along those lines, I'll just ask the first question since I'm up here. Dr. Kohravi, the whole exome sequencing for patients with CKD, is it still largely done under a research pretense, or how do we get it reimbursed in a clinical context for it to get more widespread?
Right, so I think we had done a pilot project. The sequencing right now costs somewhere between $2,500 to $5,000, depending on where you send the samples. But it's commercially available. There's resistance on the part of insurance companies to reimburse. And that was the motivation behind the study, to provide evidence. The studies that we have to date in our field were in the range of a few hundred patients. And so that's why, but that was sufficient to persuade AstraZeneca to sequence their cohort, but enough for our Institute of Genomic Medicine to think that kidney disease is an important phenotype to go after. And so our institution paid for the sequencing on a research level, and we managed to produce this data. And I think now we have great evidence, not just from our group, but from multiple other groups that demonstrate a utility. And we can use that to justify this for reimbursement.
Excellent. That would be a huge milestone to achieve. Oh, okay. So we have some questions here. All right, the first one's for Dr. Kohravi. What percentage of patients with kidney disease can take benefits of genomic sophisticated exploration? How could be the cost and the cost benefits? I think this really, you found that there was 10% yield overall in your study, but I'll let you answer.
So the 10% yield depends on the composition of the patients that you study. If you look at the paper, there's the diagnostic rate across different categories is demonstrated. So typically, if you have a patient who has early onset disease, who has a strong family history, cystic and congenital defects, they have the highest diagnostic yield. What was really surprising and also pleasing to us was that CKD of unknown etiology had a diagnostic rate of about 17%. And that's a large fraction of our patients when you think about it. 10-15% of patients with ESRD are classified as having CKD of unknown etiology. And then the diagnostic rate goes down. So you can see, so I would say if you have a young patient with a family history, CKD of unknown origin, or any type of indication of congenital defects. And then, of course, some glomerulopathies, particularly FSGS, I think are really good examples where you can have a good diagnostic yield.
Is there a question there? Okay, just so we mix it up a little. Martin, this is about the telemedicine. Have you ever looked into other lifestyle data, like sleep, movement, besides just the lab and clinical data? So I guess Fitbit, wearables, sleep quality, et cetera, they're asking.
I think, I think we have not yet looked into this. You can probably collect data from so many things nowadays with modern technology. You probably need a certain reason to do it outside of research projects. So if you do this on a regular patient, I think we have to be aware that we could not give the patient the impression that he is observed by the nephrologist in whatever he does, even during the night and how he moves. But in certain cases, sleep, apnea, and so on, it may be valuable information. So technology will develop, will allow to transfer data, I indicated that in the future we will see modular telemedicine applications, and I think these modular applications will allow for even diagnostic, to use it for diagnostic purposes. So I think the future is open.
Frank, you want to say
something? Yeah, so I would just comment. Peter's done some study with Fitbit, I know, and population of patients, comparing a population in this area of the country, I believe it was Baton Rouge, and in New York City, and it was quite an interesting set of findings with the RRI group. And then also, I know Roberto Picoy Filho in Brazil and John Larkin and others have been involved with the HD Fit study, which is specifically looking at these sort of sense devices in dialysis patients. So there is activity, I think, going on in the area.
Questions for both the telemedicine and virtual reality. How many patients are in your respective programs?
Well, I can say for the telemedicine, at the moment we are treating about 10 patients with this application on a daily basis. Of course, you have a fluctuation, but that's the number we're treating at the moment. Out of, I have to say, we are treating a total of like 28 to 30 PD patients, so it's one-third of the patients.
Are you guys still in pilot phase, or how far are you along?
Okay. We haven't started to treat patients with or to train them with the training program. We just had the evaluation, and we evaluated 20 patients. They were among 50 and 80 years old. The average was around about, I think, 60?
60, 65.
And although they were very skeptical before, they were very impressed and did it very well.
Can I just add a question? And it just brings back this issue of technology. I think I was very impressed by the presentations on telemedicine and VR that, you know, we often ask the question, is technology bringing us closer or further away from our patients? And the most common example that we bring is EHRs, and saying that necessarily they're taking us away from our patients, that a clinic visit becomes a visit with your computer rather than with a patient. But yet the technologies that were highlighted actually get us closer to our patients. In other words, I'm actually curious whether it's a Fitbit or you have to actually speak to a patient regarding his or her genetic information, that brings us closer to a patient. Engaging a patient and saying we'd like to teach you, or we actually want to communicate with you, not just by telephone, but by visual, that in fact there are technologies out there that actually get us closer. I'm just thinking in general, I'm just listening to the presentations and the debate, because of course EHR is the sort of whipping child, if you will, of how technology has moved us away from patients, yet I've just seen multiple examples of just the opposite.
For us,
great point.
And I think it brings us very much closer, especially, for example, in patients in nursing homes, where they are treated on a daily basis by nurses who have been trained, or by people, not nurses, who have been trained to do the APD treatment. So, but by the daily data transmission, they get somehow the impression and the safety that there is a kind of safety net, okay, and if they have problems, they contact us, and it allows us to treat patients with this system, which otherwise would be treated in hospital.
Great. We have a live question from the audience.
Hi. This is Maureen Lydon-Green. I'm the VP of Marketing for PD in the U.S. for the products group in Fresenius. And I just wanted to mention that we actually are doing some work with our APD product, the Liberty Cycler. We currently have over 9,000 patients that are using our modem, which transfers the treatment data daily. And the preliminary data is really exciting. We're seeing about a 3.5-month length of stay improvement on PD with the patients who are using the modem versus the patients who aren't. So we're really excited. We're trying to grow that program, and we have many upgrades in the works for that in the future.
Great. Before I go back to the cards, are there any questions that were uploaded via the app that we can access?
Maybe I can ask a question.
Sure.
Okay. Ask about the genetic diagnosis. So at the moment, so this field is rapidly developing. So when you make a genetic diagnosis today, genetic analysis, so how can we make sure that 5 years from now, the patient still gets the information, okay, will get the actual information, the new information, which is probably hidden in the result from five years earlier. So maybe to understand that there is another marker for cancer predisposition or something. So this is something I always ask, you know, when is the right time and how can we make sure that the patient is, the data are updated and the information for the patient?
So I think you're asking a really important question. I don't think anybody has the right answer because what is our obligation to continuously review existing data in the light of new information? And this is, that's, you know, particularly important for genetics where there's new information coming up all the time. And there are no standards for this. But when you think about it, there are many examples, this is also in clinical medicine. For example, we take x-rays, and there are ways of now, or CAT scans and MRIs, and there are new ways of analyzing those data. And so, or we have pathology blocks and specimens that can be stained again right. with new, you know, markers. So what is the obligation of clinicians, medical centers to be able to do this? I think one way to do this is to say the patient comes back and asks for a reanalysis. Because, you know, as we're trying to return the results to patients, we've realized that we're running into all kinds of interesting logistical issues. People have moved, some people have died, some people are disabled. Some people actually who signed up for genetic studies no longer want to get the results back. So so these are all real-world scenarios that we have to confront. One of them is going to be the what do you do with continuous review and updating. And I think probably the best way to do this is to have a doctor who has a you know long-term follow-up with the patient, and then there's an actual request that's being made, triggered either by the primary care doctor or by the patient, him or herself, to be able to do that secondary review.
But would that require another blood sample, or can you update with the data you have?
So we'd like to think that the genome sequence is not going to change, but the reality is that the techniques for acquiring the genome sequence changes, and so there may be different standards, but I think what we can obtain right now is going to be pretty good in terms of future sort of for future reinterpretation. I'm sure there will be gaps, and those were questions that will be, again, you know, come to discussion, you know, 5 years, 10 years from now.
That's an interesting point, Ali, that you mentioned that there's just a certain fraction of patients who don't want to hear about the results anymore.
Yeah, so that's been, it's been a surprise to everybody in the genetics community. I thought it was just us. Then we had a discussion, we realized that that number is about 15%.
15?
So people who have signed on for you know, clinically, you know, validated tests, they want to do it. We explained everything to them. And then when you call them back, they say, I really don't want to know about this. You know, can we just throw those results away? And it's really interesting because you're sort of, sometimes you're left with information that's really pertinent to their health.
Sure.
And what do you do with this? And again, we are used to having this as physicians, you know, hyperkalemia or other types of, you know, diagnosis that we make in our patients that, you know, and you can't track them back. Yeah.
Just have to respect their wishes and how much you can do. And there's also maybe going to be some resistance even in the technology-based platforms. There's still Absolutely. People want to use their old flip phones or their rotary phones and don't care about this virtual reality. But it looks like the majority still are welcoming all this new rush of technologies. And that's the individuality that everyone has. Frank, you wanted to add something?
So I just wanted to ask a question of thinking back to the story of the HeLa cells and Henrietta Lacks. Has there been any pushback of people who recognize that you're using effectively a fixed asset of that individual? And I'm interested in your sense of sort of the privacy issues around this.
So I think that one of the things we're, you know, any consent form has to incorporate is what do you do with the information and what are the rights of that individual to the information. The reality is that for the most part, the type of discoveries that are being made are being made in the aggregate with large populations. And so each individual then contributes, whether they are positive for a particular marker or they're negative. And so, and the way we talk about the risks and benefits of the study is that there will be, you know, the benefits would be to the greater patient community in general. But of course, now we can say in our research studies that there will may be specific benefits to the participants in the sense that we can make a significant discovery about that's going to be pertinent to their health. So, but I agree with you that these are some of the discussions that may come up as discoveries are being made. But I think collectively, the view on this right now is that you know, this is to benefit the entire community, not just the you know.
Yeah. Ravi, you and I have talked a lot about online consenting over the last few years. Do you want to just comment on that as a potential positive or negative?
Right. I just want to comment on something that Ali said, and then I'll come back to the online consent. So when we've looked at the, of course, the historical challenges, whether it be Henrietta Lacks and others, and asked in today's world, can we progress and collect samples and, again, have our patients be our partners and make discoveries? Interestingly enough, when I was in Boston and even now in Los Angeles, the answer is yes. In other words, patients are very... When there's transparency and disclosure, patients are very willing, in general, to be members of a larger community, as Ali said, aggregate, and members of a team that ultimately leads to discovery, so long as there is an understanding as to what the outcomes might be and really just the transparency and the disclosure. I think that's changed dramatically. As Ali said, when we can take a patient and say enroll in our study, we may make a discovery, but in addition, we obviously have the potential of helping you. It changes the equation necessarily. The question then you asked, Frank, which is online consenting. Interestingly enough, I would say that's just at the beginning stages in nephrology. It's much more advanced in oncology, where large sample sets of rare diseases where patients engage on computers and give online consenting, obviously with the appropriate protections and privacy. Those are the challenges today. It's really the protection and the privacy issues. I think online consenting will become standard. It's already standard in many different areas, certainly, again, in oncology, and I just think it's a matter of time before it becomes routine in all the fields. One of the challenges that we have today, when I first started doing clinical trials 20 years ago, our consent forms were 3 to 5 pages. Today, when I left Boston, they're 23 to 25 pages. And so that, given the regulatory environment, the disclosure, the transparency, the challenges and issues, I think that will be our biggest burden.
The other thing I would say is that you cannot patent DNA sequence. There's been a court ruling on this. And so when we're making, at least in terms of genomics, when we're looking at sequence variants that may indicate a particular diagnosis and a particular target for therapy, the real sort of intellectual property value is really in the compound that's going to be developed, that's going to be targeting that particular pathway or gene, and not so much in the discovery of that gene. And so we're not patenting any DNA sequence anymore. That's not, you know, that's not allowable.
In contrast to the HeLa cell experience.
Which was the developing a reagent, and then right. That's what right. Which is then used. Yes.
Yeah, these 20-page consent forms are ridiculous. I don't know who really reads them. And if you've seen some of the platforms to do e-consenting, you know, they use the diagrams of, you know, your risks, benefits, things, and it makes it so much more understandable. It's like these little visual abstracts now that we're seeing everywhere. I think it's a much more palatable platform for patients to digest what you're about to enroll them in. And then you capture that signature electronically, just like we sign our life away to Apple and Google and anything on our phone, that long thing, do you agree, do you agree? Right? So it's going to be the norm, and we should adopt it and embrace it. Paper consents are just, that's the archaic form that we should get away from. I have two questions here that are very similar. They both ask about, should we be sequencing patients who are already on dialysis or ESRD? Is there any value there?
Sure. So I think that I think there's, as doctors, we want to make a precise diagnosis. I think that's really important for us to be able to convey that information to our patients. It's important for them to know what they have. What I mean, the patients come to us and ask us, what is the cause of this disease? So I think it's important for us to provide the most precise diagnosis possible. And so that certainly, if you have a young person who is on dialysis, who has a family history, again, it's really important. Second, it might help you understand what may happen to them down the line in terms of comorbidities, for example. The classic one is having detecting Alport syndrome in terms of thinking about visual impairment, hearing loss. So setting them for the appropriate risk stratification and surveillance. You can think about family members who may be donating for, the kidneys for transplantation. And then there may be complications that may arise that may be very specific to certain genetic disorders. Again, Alport syndrome is a common one where you can have an anti-GBM type of reaction in the setting of transplantation. As I mentioned, I think probably sequencing is going to become routine for evaluation of donors and recipients. And actually, when you think about it, in cancer, we have the genome of the cancer, and we have the genome of the individual, where we make a comparison. Transplantation is another example where you have two genomes coming together, and evaluation of both of those genomes and looking at the compatibilities, but also potentially outcomes, is also going to be the way to go as we're thinking about the future of nephrology. So I think there's a lot of benefit, particularly in ESRD, when you think about this is the most severe form of disease that we have, right? People who have organ failure. And so there's got to be a way, and I think that's one answer in terms of genetics where we can sort of start to stratify our patients better.
We have about 5 minutes left. Any other oral questions from the audience? I have a compound question here that we can go to last if there's no other questions. And also, Carmen, I'm sorry, we haven't had... Do you want to comment on anything while we're waiting?
When would you consider doing genetic testing in a polycystic kidney disease patient? Younger lady comes to you. What do you do?
So polycystic kidney disease is an interesting subtype because there are two genes that we know cause 95% of this condition. And so here you probably don't need exome sequencing to be able to diagnose 95% of patients. You can clinically diagnose them with polycystic kidney disease. The question is, do you want to know whether they have polycystin 1 or polycystin 2 mutations? Knowing that this has some prognostic information with this, polycystin 2 mutants tend to progress slower and may not reach end-stage kidney disease. This has also defining, knowing what kind of mutation they have may also help you understand sort of trajectory. Loss of function mutations progress faster than missense variants. And, of course, family members, you can screen them then once you know what the mutation is to figure out who should be donating to the family, particularly if it's a young person. Then our clinical criteria right now with cysts is not sufficient to be able to figure out who's a carrier. So there are benefits. And then, of course, there's that 5% who may have now we know that there are other genetic mutations other than PKD1 and PKD2 that can cause a polycystic kidney disease. And so that's where, exome sequencing may help you figure this out as well. So there are benefits, though a targeted panel may be the way to go initially for polycystic kidney disease.
Thanks, Ellie. Thank you. Carmen,
thank you.
Did you want to say something? You were
interested. Yeah, I just wanted to stress at this point that this new technology is very useful, especially in the pediatric population, for example. They look for genetic abnormalities. And also it's most useful when you have diseases that are familiar, diseases that when you have a patient that has a new mutation that is more difficult to identify because you have tons of genes there and you need to figure out which one is the most important. When you have a family, it's different. When you have a younger patient, it's more easy to make this technology useful for the diagnosis, to put it together with the morphology. As a pathologist, we always have to try to identify things that make us think this is not a common disease and needs to be needs the support of genetic technology. So we try to be more specific as possible, try always to give the best information in order to so the patient has the best treatment. Yeah.
Okay, so we two more minutes left. We're going to use this as the last question. And it really relates to how to bring together all the relevant stakeholders, public, private, clinicians, patients, industry, academia, to help move this forward. And I guess I'll just add to that. Do you see KidneyX? If you, those of you don't know about KidneyX, is this new initiative to bring private and public funds together to try to solve some of these issues that are pressing. Their first initiative is going into new dialysis technologies, but I know that's going to be expanding as we move forward. But do you have any comments on how to change the paradigm of the way we practice? You need all these stakeholders to buy in and adopt this new paradigm. So do you guys want to comment on that?
So I'll make a first comment. I think it ultimately, to become adopted, it's going to have to be broadly across the community of all stakeholders to have some aspect of why we're changing the way we think about the diseases that we are interested in. And KidneyX is a very practical activity of trying to develop things that can have utility at end stage. I think this is far upstream from that in trying to understand how do we actually stop the disease.
Right.
And whether it's KidneyX or some other source, I think there's going to have to be one of the great opportunities is the remarkable amount of investment and energy that the world can put into trying to figure this out. And whether that's private money, public money, a combination of both, academic, non-academic, engineering, and the field that I think we are struggling with getting enough adequate talent in is computational biology, which is going to be so critical.
Sure.
Right now, all these people, you know, Lynn knows because he's tried to hire some of them, are all going to work for Amazon. And we need them to come work in healthcare.
That's right. Robbie?
Yeah, I was just, Frank said it right. It's out of necessity, right? We reach our limitations, whether it's through technology or what we bring to the table, and just by necessity, we are forced to work together, and that's inevitable.
I would say also that the onus is on us to demonstrate that when we bring to bear all these technologies, we're going to, money speaks, and so we're going to be able to save dollars and improve health at the same time. So I think having, again, rigorous trials and good, innovative ways to, look at a lot of these outcomes is going to be really important for us as we move forward, and that's how we're going to get more buy-in. And I think the opportunity we have now, paradoxically, we don't have that many treatments in the kidney space, and that has helped generate interest from industry.
Right.
So we have to be able to take this sort of opportunity to partner with them and try to, move the ball forward.
Excellent. Well, this is a very exciting time, and we're looking forward to the next decade to see how we can change this field and really help patients and improve healthcare. Thank you, everybody, for attending this morning, your attention. Thank you to the panelists and to all the speakers. It was really a wonderful morning. Thank you.